Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Council of Institutional Investors Voice of Corporate Governance, FeedSpot's number one ranked corporate governance podcast globally. I'm Jeff Mahoney, General Counsel of the Council of Institutional Investors. I'm here today with Stephen G. Ryan, the Vincent C. Ross Professor of Accounting at the Leonard N. Stern School of Business at New York University. Professor Ryan is the co-author of a recent research paper entitled Banks' Motivations for Designated Securities as Held to Maturity. Welcome, Professor Ryan. Thanks for taking time to speak with us today.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm happy to be here to talk with you about a generally important and currently salient accounting issue, particularly for banks and other types of financial institutions, but also for many other types of firms as well.
So, Professor Ryan, for those listeners who are not accountants, can you first explain how banks publicly report to investors their holdings of debt securities?
A bank or other firm uses one of three different accounting approaches for debt investment securities, depending on the firm's asserted intent regarding the security. There are two possible affirmative intents, and then one catch-all for a lack of affirmative intent. So first, debt securities that the firm asserts it intends to trade are recognized at fair value on the balance sheet. Net income includes all of the logically possible components, namely interest revenue, realized gains and losses, and unrealized gains and losses. No one argues about this accounting approach, and trading securities do not appear to have played any appreciable role in the recent bank turmoil. Hence, I won't talk about trading securities any further. Second, debt securities that the firm asserts it intends and has the ability to hold to maturity, called held to maturity securities, are recognized at amortized cost, a type of historical cost accounting, on the balance sheet. Net income includes only interest revenue, realized gains and losses, and credit loss expense under the fairly recent CECL standard. Unrealized gains and losses on held-to-maturity securities are not reflected in any of the financial statements, although these losses are disclosed in the notes to the financial statements. Importantly, accounting rules restrict firms that classify securities as held-to-maturity from selling or reclassifying the securities prior to maturity, except under limited specified circumstances. If a firm sells or reclassifies even a single held-to-maturity security under other circumstances, the firm taints its entire held-to-maturity portfolio, which needs to be reclassified to available for sale. The firm loses the ability to classify securities as held-to-maturity for 2 years. So third, debt securities for which the firm does not insert either the intent to trade or to hold to maturity, which are called available for sale securities, are recognized on the balance sheet at fair value, like trading securities. However, net income includes only interest revenue, realized gains and losses, and credit loss expense, essentially the same as for held to maturity securities, except that credit loss expense is measured somewhat differently. To accommodate the inconsistent treatment of unrealized gains and losses on the balance sheet and on the income statement, unrealized gains and losses on available for sale securities are recorded in accumulated other comprehensive income, a component of owner's equity, until they are realized, in which case they'll be reclassified out of owner's equity, out of accumulated other comprehensive income into income, and then into retained earnings. Unrealized gains and losses on available for sale securities are also disclosed in the notes to the financial statements, as is the case for held to maturity securities. In summary, current GAAP allows three distinct accounting treatments for a security based on the holder's asserted intent. In my view, this is both problematic and unnecessary for several reasons. First, it yields non-comparable accounting for identical securities, both across firms and within firms. Two firms holding identical securities, or the same firm holding two identical securities, can account for the securities differently. Second, most debt securities, particularly those held by banks, such as U.S. Treasury securities and agency mortgage-backed securities, trade in reasonably active markets. Hence, their fair values are reliably measurable without undue cost or complexity. Third, all debt securities are contractual claims to cash, assuming the markets for securities are reasonably active, so that illiquidity discounts are small or non-existent, the holder's intent has no effect on the value of the securities to the holder.
Professor Ryan, can you explain why you and many accounting and financial experts raised questions about bank reporting in connection with the failure of Silicon Valley Bank in March of last year.
Okay, so as market interest rates increased sharply beginning in the second half of 2021, fixed rate securities with maturities that are beyond short maturities, so medium or long-term maturities, experienced very sizable unrealized losses. As interest rates go up, the present value of contractual cash flows goes down, and the value of securities goes down. Prior to SVB's demise in March 2023, almost half of its assets were fixed-rate debt securities, mostly agency mortgage-backed securities that SVB classified as held to maturity. As of the end of 2022, the unrealized losses on SVB's held to maturity securities totaled $15.2 billion, which was only about $1 billion less than its total owner's equity. Had SVB classified its held to maturity securities as available for sale, then those unrealized gains and losses would have reduced its owner's equity, and its borderline insolvency would have been apparent. Moreover, SVB had unrealized losses of $2.5 billion on its available for sale securities, which were also mostly agency mortgage-backed securities. And it was SVB's sale of its available for sale securities, which gave rise to a $1.8 billion after-tax loss that triggered almost immediately its deposit run the next day. So both the disclosed unrealized losses for held to maturity and the at least partially recognized unrealized losses for available for sale securities were really not appreciated by the market until SVB sold its available for sale securities. That suggests that users of financial reports don't really pay much attention to footnote disclosures or, for that matter, to accumulated other comprehensive income.
Professor Ryan, in December 2023, the U.S. Private Sector Accounting Standards Center, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, held a public meeting to discuss an agenda request submitted via an April 2023 letter by the Council of Institutional Investors. That letter respectfully requested the FASB to consider the elimination of the held-to-maturity classification of debt securities and to consider improving financial instrument disclosures about liquidity risk and interest rate risk. Can you explain the findings of your recent research on bank reporting and why those findings provide empirical evidence supporting CI's request?
So my co-authors and I provide two sets of results that support CIA's request. First, we provide evidence that banks' assertions regarding their intent and ability to hold debt investment securities to maturity reflect their incentives to manage the reported net income, regulatory capital, and tangible owner's equity, and not distinct economic motivations. Moreover, we show that banks' assertions regarding this intent and ability reliably change as their incentives change. That is, what banks assert today about their intent does not reliably correlate with what they will assert tomorrow about that intent. To properly explain this set of results requires some details about bank regulation and our research design. So we examined three size-based groups in an overall sample of 297 publicly traded banks. Due to differences in bank regulations, these groups of banks have different income, regulatory capital, and tangible owner's equity management incentives. We examined four distinct sub-periods of the years 2012 to 2022. In particular, we examined variation across the bank groups and changes across the sub-periods and whether unrealized gains and losses on available for sale securities are included in regulatory capital. Prior to 2014, these unrealized gains and losses were excluded from regulatory capital for all banks. As a result, banks classified about 90% of their debt investment securities as available for sale during this period. Banks found this treatment desirable because unrealized gains and losses on available for sale securities did not affect their net income or their regulatory capital, and banks had no restrictions on selling or reclassifying available for sale securities. Then, over a five-year phase-in period beginning in 2014, under the initial U.S. implementation of Basel III, unrealized gains and losses on available for sale securities were included in regulatory capital for very large or international so-called advanced approaches banks with assets exceeding $250 billion or foreign exposure exceeding $10 billion. For the other banks, these unrealized gains and losses did not affect regulatory capital. We find that as the phase-in occurred for the advanced approaches banks, these banks reclassified substantial amounts of available for sale securities to held to maturity in order to insulate their regulatory capital from unrealized gains and losses on the securities. Then in 2019, under the so-called tailoring rules, unrealized gains and losses on available for sale securities were again excluded from regulatory capital for previously advanced approaches banks with assets from $250 billion to $700 billion or foreign exposures from $10 billion to $75 billion. Basically, these are the smaller of the previously advanced approaches banks. The affected banks then immediately reclassified substantially all of their held-to-maturity securities to available for sale, despite the restrictions on reclassification of securities out of held-to-maturity. And finally, as interest rates began to rise around the end of 2021, banks of all sizes, all three groups, reclassified available for sale securities to held to maturity to insulate primarily their tangible owner's equity from unrealized gains and losses. Tangible owner's equity is a non-GAAP owner's equity measure that excludes most intangible assets, but includes unrealized gains and losses on available for sale securities. Banks did this reclassification because the Federal Home Loan Banks are restricted from lending to banks with negative tangible owner's equity. Federal Home Loan Bank borrowings are banks' primary source of non-deposit borrowing. In an average period, they're about 5% of banks' total borrowing. But actually, in times when other sources of financing tend to dry up, this percentage rises. So Federal Home Loan Bank advances are a very important source of financing for banks. In summary, we find that each of the three sets of banks, three groups of banks' assertions regarding debt securities in each of the four subperiods, so basically have 12 separate observations, if you like, reflects the bank's income, regulatory capital, and tangible owner's equity management incentives. Our bottom line is that allowing banks to pick their accounting treatment for debt investment securities by asserting unverifiable, and temporarily inconsistent intents simply enables banks to manage their net income, regulatory capital, and tangible owner's equity. So that's the first set of results. Second, we provide evidence that aside from the group of the largest banks, so the biggest of the previously advanced approaches banks, banks that classify debt investment securities as held to maturity poorly manage the interest rate risk of all of their debt investment securities, including their available for sale securities. Specifically, banks that reclassify debt investment securities from available for sale to held to maturity lengthen the maturity of all of their debt investment securities, both available for sale and held to maturity, and hedge these securities less using interest rate derivatives. This poor risk management has increased the systematic risk of individual banks and the banking system, in part because an increasing percentage of banks' deposits are not FDIC guaranteed and thus subject to runs, as we saw in the case of SVB. Our bottom line is that held-to-maturity security classification makes banks feel insulated from interest rate risk, and as a result, they manage that risk poorly. Our evidence contradicts the view that held-to-maturity classification captures banks' risk management. SVB is the poster child for this poor risk management behavior, but our evidence shows that the behavior is actually quite widespread, at least amongst all but the very largest banks.
Professor Ryan, at the Financial Accounting Standard Board's December public meeting, the board decided that they would not add a project to its standard setting agenda in response to the Council of Institutional Investors' April letter. Board members said that many investors have the information they need on debt securities in the financial statement footnotes. Board member Susan M. Cosper said, quote, "I don't think there's a problem to solve," unquote. Professor Ryan, what was your reaction to the FASB's December decision? And can you explain to our listeners the problem with the current accounting standards for debt securities and how the FASB could solve that problem?
So the main problem with Ms. Cowper's response is that considerable empirical evidence exists. Disclosure in notes is not an adequate substitute for recognition in financial statements, given the behavior of users of financial statements, including relatively sophisticated users such as financial analysts. Moreover, similar findings exist showing that recognition of unrealized gains and losses in accumulated other comprehensive income is not an adequate substitute for recognition of the unrealized gains and losses in net income. Some of this evidence specifically examines banks' unrealized gains and losses on available for sale and held to maturity investment securities. For example, a paper published in 2019 by Bouland, Lobo, and Pogram shows that both investors and financial analysts do not pay sufficient attention to banks' disclosed unrealized gains and losses on available for sale securities, and that this lack of attention yields lengthy lags in banks' securities prices. A 2023 working paper by Dick Nielsen and Thimpson examining the recent banking turmoil shows that the market did not appreciate the deposit run risk associated with banks' massive disclosed unrealized gains and losses on securities and loans prior to the March 2023 run on SVB's deposits. My interpretation of this body of evidence is that most users of financial reports, including sophisticated ones, meaningfully consider note disclosures and AOCI only when sufficiently salient external events prompt them to do so. So in the case of SVB's, selling their available for sale securities portfolio and experiencing a deposit run, that led users of financial reports to think more carefully about the disclosures and also AOCI for all banks. But prior to that, they didn't do it for any bank, including SVB. In my view, a related and also important economic problem with Ms. Cowper's response is that our evidence shows that note disclosure of unrealized gains and losses on held to maturity securities and AOCI recognition of unrealized gains and losses on available for sale securities, but not recording unrealized gains and losses on either of those types of securities in net income or including the unrealized gains and losses in regulatory capital. This leads many banks to manage the risks of their securities poorly. This increases the risk of individual banks and potentially also the risk of the overall banking system. While this is most obviously a problem for bank regulators, it is also something the FASB should consider, I think. The potential solutions to this problem are obvious. My preferred solution is to require all debt investment securities that trade in reasonably active markets to be accounted for at fair value on the balance sheet, recognized at fair value, with all logical income components recorded in net income, the same way that we currently do for trading securities and also for equity securities. Barring that, CII's request to eliminate held to maturity security classification would eliminate a very big piece of the problem, but it still wouldn't address the fact that recognition of unrealized gains and losses in AOCI still is not fully appreciated by investors. And so the second part of their request, which is to provide better disclosures about interest rate risk and management of that risk, is also quite important.
Professor Ryan, final question. If you were the chair of the Financial Accounting Standards Board, what would be your top three priorities and why?
This is a very big open-ended question, so I'm going to limit myself to the main issues that apply to the types of financial instruments held by banks and other financial institutions, which is my primary research and teaching focus. The first two issues I will raise relate to the topic of our discussion thus far. First, and in my view, the biggest overarching problem for banks is the mixed attribute accounting model, in which different financial assets and liabilities are measured using four different primary bases. Simplifying somewhat, trading and risk management instruments, such as derivatives, generally are recognized at fair value on the balance sheet with unrealized gains and losses recorded in net income. Available for sale securities are recognized at fair value on the balance sheet, but unrealized gains and losses are recorded in accumulated other comprehensive income. Most other financial assets, including held to maturity securities, are recognized at amortized cost, subject to some form of credit impairment under the CECL standard or another standard. Most other liabilities are measured at amortized cost. This model yields bottom line financial statement numbers, both on the balance sheet and the income statement, that reflect varying combinations of apples, oranges, bananas, and strawberries, four different types of measurement approaches. This combination of fruit makes for very hard to interpret financial statements, particularly the bottom line numbers, though it does make for a pretty good smoothie. Admittedly, the mixed attribute model would be an impossible nut for the FASB or its constituents such as CII that care about good financial reporting to crack in one fell swoop. However, I think the biggest roadblock to progress on bank accounting is the accounting for deposits without contractual maturity, such as checking accounts and savings accounts. These deposits typically constitute a majority of banks' liabilities. The economic value of these deposits includes the value of an embedded, non-contractual, and thus intangible asset associated with the stickiness of deposit interest rates. Basically, as interest rates rise, banks tend not to raise the rates they pay on deposits quite at the same level. And as interest rates fall, then they tend to return rates, deposit rates down to low levels. The stickiness arises from both banks' behavior in terms of not raising rates, but also depositors' behavior. A lot of depositors value convenience, and they're not that interest rate sensitive, at least if interest rates don't move too much. Under current GAAP, deposits without contractual maturity must be recognized at amortized cost. In particular, the fair value option cannot be elected for these deposits, and economic hedges of the embedded intangible asset cannot receive hedge accounting. The accounting treatment for these deposits was recently cited by many of the FASB's board members as a reason not to change the accounting for held to maturity securities. So it illustrates how the mixed attribute accounting model ends up deteriorating the accounting for all of different types of financial instruments. At a minimum, I think the recent banking turmoil indicates that the FASB, or possibly the SEC or some combination of the two, needs to require banks to provide better information about the historical stickiness of their deposits without contractual maturity, and whether this stickiness can reasonably be expected to persist, say based on whether the bank has net unrealized gains or net unrealized losses on its assets and liabilities. So for example, SVB, with huge net unrealized losses on its assets, would have found it very difficult to assert that its deposits would remain sticky. More ambitiously, if a bank can provide sufficient evidence that it can estimate the stickiness of its deposits without contractual maturity adequately well, say based on historical experience, then I would favor allowing the bank to elect the fair value option for the intangible asset embedded in these deposits. If that were the case, then the argument that the reason to keep held-to-maturity securities at amortized cost because they have an economic hedge, which is the deposits, would go away. And you could fair value both the held-to-maturity securities and the deposits. So that's my first topic. The second topic is, in my view, both intent-based accounting for securities and amortized cost accounting for any adequately liquid financial instrument yields unnecessarily non-comparable and economically nonsensical accounting. These instruments generally are direct or indirect contractual claims to cash. Their fair values can be measured largely or entirely using market information. There's no reason for two banks holding the same security or the same bank holding two identical securities to account for the securities differently. I discussed this problem earlier, and I think the solution to it is fairly straightforward. Third, a separate topic, by far the most important recent standard the FASB has written affecting banks is the CECL credit loss standard. It affects banks' loans and held-to-maturity securities, which collectively are a disproportionate portion of their assets. The immediate expensing of lifetime expected credit losses on loans and other financial assets under the primary CECL model is both highly conservative and does not capture the economics of lending. Banks generally don't originate loans that they expect to be bad investments. Therefore, writing those loans down immediately makes no sense. This non-capture of the economics of lending is a form of non-neutrality. Non-neutrality is the primary reason why the FASB disavowed conservatism as a qualitative characteristic of financial reporting in its revision of the concept statements, particularly Con 8. Moreover, despite the conservatism of the primary CECL model, the accounting it yields is pro-cyclical, not counter-cyclical, for the simple reason that lifetime loss rates rise very substantially in economic down periods. Thus, banks aren't going to want to write loans in economic down periods if they're going to have to record very big upfront lifetime losses. The FASB could easily substantially ameliorate these problems by adopting its own CECL model, which it applies to purchased credit deteriorated assets using present value methods. There's two separate models for purchased credit deteriorated asset. The present value model is better. Rather than expensing the expected lifetime losses at origination, this model adds the expected losses to the net carrying value of the loans and reduces the effective interest rate on the loans. As a result, the way that the expected credit losses get reflected is by reduced interest revenue over the life of the loans, rather than by a big upfront loss being recorded. This would be economically neutral, clearly preferable accounting.
That concludes our podcast episode. On behalf of the Council of Institutional Investors, I want to thank my special guest, Stephen G. Ryan, the Vincent C. Ross Professor of Accounting at the Leonard N. Stern School of Business at New York University. If you have any questions or comments regarding this podcast, please feel free to contact me at Jeff, that's J-E-F-F, at CII.org. Till next time, I'm Jeff Mahoney. Thanks for listening to the voice of corporate governance.